and welcome to the latest season of Immigrantly. I am your host, Sathya Khan. Today, we welcome a very special guest, one who you might say shares a similar role as me, that is talking to people, researching stories, and broadcasting them to the public. His name is Latif Nasir, and let me tell you, this guy wears a lot of hats, figuratively that is. Most visibly, Nasir is the director of research at WNYC's Radiolab, and he recently launched a podcast called The Other Latif. It's a six-part series which is about his notorious but unintended namesake, a detainee at Gitmo, held for his alleged involvement with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
This is a story about two nerdy Muslim kids from the suburbs named Latif Nasir. I'm one of them, and the other is detainee number 244 at Guantanamo Bay. I've spent 3 years obsessed with this guy, retracing his story from his home in Casablanca to the most notorious prison in the world. I'm trying to find the truth in a place outside the bounds of law. It's tough to know who to trust, whether they're a CIA agent or a former detainee. This is the hardest story I've ever reported. Was he a member of the Taliban?
Classified.
Was he tortured?
Yes.
This started as a story about a name, but it became so much more. The public needs to know about it because this is a story about the most fundamental American values: life, liberty, the rule of law.
Sounds intriguing, right? I am 2 episodes in, and trust me, it's scintillating to say the least. And for those of you who are finding they have more time now on their hands, it's the perfect midday pick-me-up. Pour yourself some chai and be carried away. We will talk about this particular project during our interview, as I will definitely prod Nasir for some exclusive details. Now back to the hats. Nasir is a journalist, a doctor in history of science, a TED Talk presenter, and self-proclaimed nerdy writer type guy with a lot of ideas and a lot of stories. Let's give a warm welcome to Latif Nasir.
I wanted him to move, I wanted to scream, none of those things happened, and it, like, you know, it was whatever it was, 45 seconds or 90 seconds or something like that, then they just ushered us on, and that's the closest I got to him, was like on the other side of a one-way glass window where he didn't know I was there, and I didn't know for sure that he was there.
Thank you so much for coming on my show. I'm very excited.
I am too. I'm excited too. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
First off, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right. This is such an extraordinary time. This is such an extraordinary moment right now. The world is fully upside down, and it is, yeah, I feel like just as a journalist, like I just finished this big, long series that I'm here to talk to you about, but at the same time, I just... like I had a giant list of all the things I was looking forward to doing after, you know, this labor of making that series. But now I threw that list away, and now I'm just like chasing all kinds of new stories about this upside down moment we're living in right now. It feels like it's been eons since I did the story that I want to talk to you about.
Yeah. So Latif, let me ask you something before we delve into the story and everything else. How do you pronounce your name? Because I grew up in Pakistan and
right.
I pronounce it as Latif, but I don't think you pronounce it as Latif. So I just wanted to make sure we are on the same page.
No, it's such a funny thing. Like, I often joke that I mispronounce my own name. So I say Latif. That's what my parents say too, Latif. And then Latif is kind of in my head what I've been calling the guy who I've become obsessed with. Latif, or Abdul Latif, is how I pronounce his name. But my own name, I say Latif.
Oh, so I should be pronouncing it as Latte.
You're fine. You're fine. You're saying it more correctly than I do. So I think you have a free hall pass to use whatever pronunciation you want.
Oh, thank you. I feel good about this. So you're living in LA, but you're producing for a New York-based organization, right? So you're already doing remote work lifestyle.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, it's not such a big change.
So in what ways has COVID-19 pandemic changed or not changed what you're doing? Like, is there anything that has drastically changed?
Drastically changed is the ability to travel to go do interviews or to go meet people or to go. Mm. I mean, I think really nothing beats seeing someone face to face, visiting a place that you're talking about and actually getting to understand it. For instance, for the Guantanamo series that I did, I don't know if that was a spoiler, if that should have come out of my mouth. But anyway, but for the series I already did, so many of my sources were so skittish, were so hesitant to talk that actually sitting in front of them face to face, being able to look somebody in the eye, it really makes a big difference in the quality of the kind of story you can report, the information that you're going to get. And so right now I'm doing all of these interviews the way we're doing this interview, right? Hmm. Which is like, I'm staring at my computer screen. You're probably staring at a computer screen. It's, you know, there is a way in which it's more intimate, actually, oddly. Like, I'm in my home in my pajamas. You're probably in your home in your pajamas. Like, there is a way in which it's more intimate, but also, like, there's a different way in which it's like, you're in your bubble and I'm in my bubble, but if we're sitting together, there's a different kind of trust that comes out of that, you know?
Absolutely. And I get it because I normally do my interviews in a studio setting, even if I'm doing a remote call like a Skype or a Zoom, it's always in a studio setting. So I am in that mindset. And right now I feel like I just have to create that environment, and it doesn't happen because, as you said, sitting home, it doesn't give me that feeling of connecting with someone. But I'm learning. Like, yesterday was my first interview, today is the second, so it is getting better. But let's talk about the other Latif, because you just mentioned, and I mentioned it in my intro as well, this is like a series which has multiple episodes, and it appears to be one of your larger journalistic undertakings, right? You've traveled a lot for this. You've spent a lot of physical time doing research and traveling, and you discovered a lot of stuff during the process, right? The series does draw on this geopolitical conversation, but it goes beyond that. There is this, how do I say, this soft and intimate moment that you share about your own history, which is incredible. So I don't want to disclose too much because I want listeners to listen to this series. How did you decide on pursuing Abdul Latif Nasser as your focus, and what kept you going?
Yeah, it's funny. I like, so much of my job is chasing stories. Like, I go out and I look for stories. I shake the trees. I look for stories. I try to find stories. I try to find stories. I try to find stories. And then this was the first time where a story found me, where it felt like it just plucked me and I had to tell it and I couldn't not tell it. And every moment where I wasn't working on it or wasn't telling it, I felt that there was a guy with my name who was, I just could imagine him sitting in Guantanamo Bay, not having had a trial, and just kind of like, I just could imagine him sitting there. And I was like, that feels unfair. Like, this guy's case, it feels like when I started, there was almost nothing about him. Nothing. Like, you, like, how often do you Google something and there's like nothing? Like, and that's basically what this was. And so I just felt like I couldn't not do it. I couldn't not do it because I knew nobody else was going to. And actually, it turned out that other people did. Over the course of while I was reporting this, there were a few other articles about this guy, and those reporters, I think, are incredible for writing about him. But like, when I started, there was almost nothing. And even those articles that did come out, I mean, they were good, but it's like, Guantanamo is not an issue that really catches people. And I felt like I had a hook. I had a way in that felt super compelling for me, and I thought that I could make it compelling for everybody else. And so it was this story that I, it's funny, like you asked the question of like, how do you, what made you keep going? How did you feel about mm-hmm. it? It was like kind of the opposite for me. It was like, how could I not do this? How could I not? Like, it reached out from the universe and it grabbed me.
Did you ever second guess for how politically risky this story was, or even for your own safety? Because if I found out that there was somebody by the name of Sadia Khan sitting in Gitmo, I would be like, I don't want to do anything with this person. I don't want to know what this person is all about.
Isn't there a Shah Rukh Khan movie? My name is Khan, right?
That's yeah.
I feel like that could be.
Yeah.
But I felt like because it in a way it bugged me like mm-hmm. it bugged me because there were kind of two possibilities in my mind based on the two stories that I first found out about this guy. I first found out about this guy on a tweet that I thought was about me. It wasn't about me. I looked into him and then I found these like two just starkly contrasting portraits. I found there was a portrait from a leaked government document that said, look, this guy is like, you know, Osama bin Laden's right-hand man. This guy was a really, really, really bad guy who sort of carried out tragedies, you know? And then there was another portrait that I got from his shortly thereafter from his lawyer who said, no, this guy's totally innocent. He didn't do any of this stuff. You know, he never had a relationship with bin Laden. He was never in Al-Qaeda. He never blew up the Bamiyan Buddha statues. He never did this. He never did that. So I had these two portraits of this guy. And in a way, I kept thinking, like, no matter which of these is true, like it still bugs me. Like it bugs me if this guy, as his lawyer claimed, had been locked up for almost 20 years without charges, without a trial, tortured. Like that's, you know, that's a miscarriage of justice. That's like, right. That's wrong. That's not supposed to happen in the modern world. That's wrong. And that bugged me. And that nobody was talking about it. And then the other option also bugged me, like this idea that there was a guy with my name who had done these heinous things. And then I was like, oh, that bugs me too. Like, and what would have made this guy, what would have driven this guy to do these sorts of things? Like these things that are like, sure, we've all heard of like Osama bin Laden and he's attacking civilians in all these places. He's blowing up embassies with innocent people inside. Like you kind of get that idea. He's sort of he's like a cartoon villain in a way. Like you don't really need to know much more about him. But then I was like, but here's this guy I'd never heard of with my name. You know, I'd never met someone with my name before. It felt special. And yet here he was. And if he did these heinous things, I wanted to know why. Like, who was this guy? What did he do? And so both possibilities there just irked me and bugged me. And it just made me want to know more. Like, who is this guy? What did he do? Why did he do it? Or what was done to him? And why was it done to him? All of these questions, like I just, and then just punching them into Google and being able to find nothing, you know, that it was just very frustrating. I was like, I need to figure this out.
See, that's another thing. I would never have Googled anybody who is in Gitmo because I think maybe I'm so scared of being judged or surveilled, maybe.
Oh my god. I was very much the same way. I would be like calling my colleagues. I'd be like, can you Google?
Exactly.
And then I would like literally tell them what to Google.
Yeah, I remember at work, I used to work for a civil society organization, and we were doing a lot of research on countering violent extremism. Mm-hmm. And I remember I used to ask my colleagues to do most of the research. Because in my mind, I was like, you know, somebody with the name Sadia Khan is a red flag to begin with because it's a Muslim name. And that's the irony of it. But you pursued it, right? So walk us through the process.
Well, let me first tell you another story just like that. I was very, very sort of sheepish to enter those search terms, to download those kinds of like to lurk on those websites and like just find out anything about this stuff. And then at some point I was like, my curiosity is more than my fear. I'm just going to do this. I don't care. And there was this one moment, and it's so vivid for me, I won't be able to forget it. I was traveling. I was coming in on, I was staying in the suburbs, and then I was going by train and Metro North into New York City. and had my laptop open, and I was working on my laptop, and there was this little girl, and she was sitting next to me, and she was just so cute, and she started talking to me, and so it was on the sort of seat. It was me and then this little girl, maybe 4 years old or so, and then her mom right next to her. And this little girl starts talking to me, and she tells me her name, and I say, oh, that's my niece's name. And so I was like, okay, let me show you a picture of my niece, like, because I had my computer already open. I said, why not? You know, you guys have the same name. So I swiveled the computer around, and I pulled up the picture of my niece, and then I closed the picture, and then the thing that was behind was literally, I'm not even kidding, and I didn't realize I had downloaded this literally Al Qaeda training manual, and so it said the PDF said on the top, like, Al Qaeda training manual in big letters, because that's what I had labeled the file. And the mom was looking at my computer too. And so it said, like, I'm on a train on the way into New York City, and I have on my computer this thing, and in big letters it says Al Qaeda training manual. And I, like, just slammed my laptop shut, and I was like, oh my God. And I was like, did she, like, she didn't, she, like, clearly, she didn't acknowledge it. And I was like, is she about to call the cops on me?
That's,
like,
what I was thinking.
And then I was like, oh, and by the way, I'm a journalist. And then I started, like, just nervously rambling. but yeah, there were all these moments where I was like, I should not have this on my computer. Like, this is feels very incriminating. But I was curious, and I wanted to know if this guy was in Al Qaeda, like, what would that have looked like? What would that have been like? What would that have felt like? What would that have, you know, I wanted to know everything. And I did have a lot of fear, but my curiosity just was more than my fear. And I just said, you know, I'm just going to do it anyway.
So what were the next steps? What did you do next? Once you found out about this guy and you were curious, you started doing some research.
Well, I found every bit of information I could find. I ended up doing, I don't know, like, over a dozen interviews with his, or I don't know, something like that, with his lawyer, just getting as much information as I could from her. But she was quite hamstrung in what she was able to say, because if she says something that's classified, she could be disbarred, go to prison, all these horrible things. So she's very, very careful in what she says. I also found there were a bunch of leaked documents about this guy. And so I went over everything that was declassified and leaked that I could find about this guy. I emailed the Pentagon a bunch of times. They'd be like, no, we can't talk about this guy. So I was trying to find every which way. I figured out where his family was. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to try to go meet his family. I tried to interview other former released Guantanamo detainees, which as a population I've never dealt with. Like, as a group, I would say they're the hardest sources I've ever dealt with in my whole career. They're just very, very, there's so many issues, you know, where you're trying to sort of approach them and ask them questions in a way that is, I'm sure, very reminiscent to them of being interrogated. And why would they willingly subject themselves to that, and much less that, you know, they're in very complicated social situations. Anyway, so I was just trying to imagine every possible avenue I could get to this guy, because what I quickly found out was I was not allowed to talk to him. There was everything that literally, as it comes out of his mouth, if he says anything, it's immediately classified. Literally, as it comes out of his mouth, if he talks about, I want to drink lemonade, that is classified. So I realized he was a black box, and he was going to remain a black box to me. And instead, what I had to do is just find every other avenue to kind of, like, a bank shot. Like, I needed anything I could find from anywhere else that would help me get to him.
So, Latif, what was the end goal? Did you have anything in mind? Were you trying to see whether he was guilty? What were you trying to achieve by doing all of this?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm not even sure I knew for sure. But a huge part of it, that was a kind of a basic part of it, was like, is this guy guilty or is he not? Hmm. And whatever the answer to that question is, it's like, how did he wind up at Guantanamo? And what has happened to him? I mean, so the guilty or not, it did feel like, I was like, since this guy hasn't had a trial, I'm I'm going to give this guy a trial. Like, I'm going to give this guy a trial in my garage, if that's what it takes. Like, because this feels like un-American, and it feels unfair. And I think that this guy deserves some consideration after over a decade and a half of being sort of ignored and forgotten.
So you just mentioned that you even tried to reach out to his family, which you did. And in your second episode, you admit when introducing yourself to his family is that you say that I'm a journalist. And in fact, I'm very skeptical of the American government. Can you tell us a little bit about why you made that comment and how does it shape your actions as a citizen and a journalist? And how did it shape your pursuit of this story?
Yeah. I knew rolling up to that house, to that family, to talk to them, like I was imagining myself as them. Their brother had been kept by the American government for over a decade and a half with no charges, with no trial. And they know, I'm sure, from press accounts that he's been tortured. Like that, if that had happened to a family member of mine, there is no way that I would, you know, have rosy feelings towards the American government.
Yeah.
And here I was rolling in a total stranger from the United States, working for a public radio company. You know, like I didn't know they had never done any interviews with the press, you know, that I, as far as I knew, like they'd never spoken about him publicly. Hmm. And so I was rolling up and I was like, I know nothing about this family. The only thing really I know, which I can kind of intuit, is that they're probably skeptical of the American government. I am also very skeptical of the American government, and I should probably say that.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
I know, and in a way, I really do think that that's part of my job description. Like, it really is. I think no matter whether it's Obama or Bush or Republicans or Democrats or this or Trump, it's our job to go after the truth. It's our job to hold people accountable. It's our job to see things that everybody else wants to hide. It's our job to ask tough questions and to ask, you know, to afflict the comforted and comfort the afflicted, that kind of thing. Like that's our job.
So how was your interaction with his family? How did that meeting go?
Oh, it was exactly the opposite of what I expected to happen.
What did you expect?
I went in expecting, like I said, like these people are going to be very, very skeptical of me. Like, how am I going to get them to open up? How am I going to get them to talk to me? Like, I don't think they're going to say anything to me. Like, maybe they're politely sort of indulging me out of curiosity or something that they want to have me over. But I didn't think they were going to say anything to me really that was meaningful. And then I walked in and it was the opposite. Like, it wasn't that they didn't trust me. It felt like the opposite. So within minutes of when I got there, they were going to offer us some food and, you know, like welcoming snacks kind of thing. Mm. And I went to go wash my hands. And as I went to go wash my hands, one of Abdul Latif's sisters ran up to me in the hall and she just started talking, like she just started, like just really fast. And so what she said was, look, like I knew you were coming, I knew you had his name, but what I did not know was that you have his height, you have his build, you look like him, and you're the same age as he was when I last saw him. And I just, like, I can't even describe how strange that felt. Like, and she kept saying, I feel like I've time traveled back and I'm with my brother and you're my brother and you're a part of the family and now call me sister. She said that the rest of the thing she was saying in Arabic, and then that she said in English, and she like kind of looked me right in the eyes. She said, call me sister. And to me, I mean, it's like I felt so bad for this family, like I had sort of inadvertently stepped into. There was a hole in their family, and it was this hole was sort of my height and shape, you know. And they were kind of like, in a way, I talked to one of the sort of social workers who had worked with them, and it's like they're in grief, they're in mourning for their brother who they can't have with them, you know. And it's like, even though he's still alive, to them, in a way, he might as well be dead, you know? And so they have this very complicated emotional relationship with him, towards him. And I kind of walked into that. So, and I felt just so bad for this family. But at the same time, I was like, I don't know who this guy with my name is. I don't want to pretend to be him because he might have done kind of unspeakably horrible things. I wouldn't pretend to be Osama bin Laden or something, you know? And so it was a kind of this weird moment where I was like, do I call her sister? Like, it's so strange. Like, I don't know how to feel about this, but I don't think this family had anything to do with that. And I think that they're really suffering. Like, they're suffering for reasons that have nothing to do with them. Even if their brother did do stuff, like, that has nothing to do with them. They lost track of him by that point, and for them it was this sort of unfair burden. So then I called her sister, and I was like, okay, hi, sister. And they sort of kept talking to me about family and how I was part of the family, and it was difficult because I, in a way, it felt like I was going in worrying, are they going to trust me? And then they trusted me too much. I was like, no, don't trust me this much. Like, you need to be a little bit more guarded here, because this is like, you don't know who I am. I could be, you know, like I could be, and I wasn't, but like, you don't know what kind of journalist I am. You don't know my work. Like, don't trust me this much. I want you to trust me, but don't trust me. Like, this is too much, you know?
Do you think they had like this heightened sense of what you could do for them and these expectations that were built during that meeting? And how did that pan out then? What happened after that?
Yeah, no, and you're exactly right. Like, I think what they noticed, and like, in a way, all the legal ways to get him out failed. All the legal ways to get him out. I mean, he checked all those boxes. He's been, so this guy, Abdul Latif Nasser, and this is a point I maybe even should have said earlier, but like, he was officially cleared for transfer back to his home in Morocco. He went through, he got all the legal things he needed to get out. And I think from the family's perspective, it was like, look, like, he did the legal stuff. He did the on paper stuff that he was supposed to do, and that didn't work. And so we kind of, the courts have let us down. And so our only other option, in a way, is the court of public opinion. And then here comes a journalist who takes an interest. And, you know, it turned out another journalist had talked to them before that, but I didn't know that. And two journalists over, you know, over almost 20 years, like, that's, you know, I think it sort of, my presence there sort of sparked a hope that they maybe could, like, this might be the thing. This might be the thing that finally gets their brother out. And so I think that was a tremendous amount of pressure, like, to feel that this whole family, a pretty big family, feeling like I was their, you know, I was as important to their brother's case as his lawyer was, you know, that like I had this power, and that they were counting on me. And when I went there, like, I feel like I had this sort of built up in my head, this kind of like metaphysical resonance between me and this guy with my name. And it was this weird thing that I would sort of tell my colleagues about, and they'd be like, okay, we kind of get what you're talking about. But it felt like a very personal thing to me. And then I went to the family and I was like, oh wow, they feel it even harder than I do. Like, it wasn't just me projecting on this guy. Now his family is projecting this onto me, you know? And so that just felt like it was a lot. And that was one of the earlier trips I made, reporting trips I made in the reporting of this series. And it kind of, I think it lent a kind of a much more intense, like, a gravity to the whole rest of it. Like, it was like, oh, the family. And I didn't want to be beholden to it, because I you know, I'm not trying to warp the facts in the favor of innocence or anything like that. But it did feel like I was like, wow, this family is paying attention. And I, yeah, like, I need to say the truth, but I know that the family is going to be listening to everything that I put out.
And Latif, you also visited the other Latif in Gitmo. From what I've heard, you weren't able to like really see him or meet with him, but you were there.
Yeah. So it's an extraordinary place. And I mean, it was kind of purposefully made that way, Guantanamo, to be like outside of everything, outside of international laws, outside of American laws. when I found out that I was going there, I put in a request to meet this guy. Hmm. And they denied that request on the grounds of the Geneva Convention. They said, no, you can't, which is like, to me, there was a kind of...
Are they really following Geneva Convention in all of this?
So that's the question, right? Like, in a way, they created this place to be outside of international law, outside of the Geneva Convention.
Exactly.
And they said at the beginning that they would be running the whole thing in the spirit of the Geneva Conventions, but not like it's not, I forget the exact phrase they use. I think it was in the spirit of or something like that. But then obviously like torture and the kinds of things that they did there were very much not in the spirit of the Geneva Conventions. Now, as far as I know and believe and has been reported, there is no more torture going on at Guantanamo Bay. They are trying to be a much more kind of rule-bound, following international and American kind of norms as to how they treat their prisoners. They're trying to do that, so far as I can tell. That said, yeah, they weren't allowed. I mean, I wasn't allowed to meet this guy. I wasn't allowed to talk to him. I wasn't allowed to, you know. So that feels abnormal. And so I put in that request. They didn't let me talk to him, but they did let me do this other thing, which they said was in line with the Geneva Conventions, which to me feels, I don't know, I kind of want to talk to the Department of Defense lawyer who made this distinction. But basically what I was allowed to do was they took me into the detention facility and along with a few fellow reporters who were on the same media tour. And they basically turned out the lights in the detention center. And what you could do is you sort of walk down this hallway where the lights are off. And what you can see is there are these like windows into the different cell blocks, right? So it's like a prison. You're walking through a prison through a hallway. There are these cell blocks with windows. And then those windows, though, are one-way glass. So you can see in. They can't see out.
Oh.
And so you're walking from cell block to cell block, and they give you about like 90 seconds to go to each of these windows and to look inside. And so really what it feels like is it feels like you're at the zoo. It feels like you're in the, you know, reptile house or whatever at the zoo, and you're going and you're looking for, like in my case, it felt like, again, it's so eerie and strange. It felt like I was looking for my favorite animal at the zoo.
And I was trying to find him.
And you're so close. Like I'd been reporting about this guy for like 3 years, and like I'm so close to him. And yet, like if he was in his cell, then I wouldn't have seen him. But if he was in the common area of that cell block, then I would have seen him.
Hmm.
And so I'm going from cell block to cell block. And then at the final cell block, I saw someone sitting in a corner with a big white beard. He had a big white beard with a prayer cap. He usually wears a prayer cap. He's sitting there, but there was this shadow that cut across his face, cut across his body and his face diagonally in such a way that I could not say for sure. I've stared at his picture so many times for so many hours. I couldn't tell whether it was him or not. And he was just sitting there. And I was like, just move. Just move a little bit. I wanted to scream out his name, which is my name. And I wanted to scream out. And I couldn't because, we were being escorted by all these guards. And I wanted to. I wanted him to move. I wanted to scream. None of those things happened. And it was whatever it was, 45 seconds or 90 seconds or something like that. Then they just ushered us on. And that's the closest I got to him, was like on the other side of a one-way glass window where he didn't know I was there and I didn't know for sure that he was there.
You have done a lot of research. You've created this series. I'm sure there is a conclusion. And without disclosing that, I'm just asking you, have you concluded whether he is guilty or not? And you don't have to tell us because I want people to listen to the series.
Yeah, sure.
Is there a conclusion in the end?
You definitely get a conclusion in the end. And I think, well, what you get two things, and I'll tell you one of them and I won't tell you the other one.
Okay.
The one you get, which actually you also find out in the first episode, is that a nonpartisan panel of six people representing six of the most important agencies of the U.S. government came together and unanimously decided that this guy was no longer a threat to the United States, that he shouldn't be continued to be held at Guantanamo Bay, and that he should be sent home. That actually, we even start the whole series with. That's not a spoiler in a way. So the U.S. government has already decided that he does not belong there, despite the fact that they haven't, you know, they decided not to release him. That said, I then went over his whole file and to the degree the leaked and classified stuff that I could, and I may make my own decision based on the facts that I found, what I think about this guy, which I will not tell you but it is very much in the final episode. And also kind of, I like for listeners, I kind of, in a way, what I tried to do in the whole series is sort of show my work to be like, look, here is all the evidence that I dug up, the really damning stuff and the really exculpatory stuff, the stuff that makes him look good, the stuff that makes him look bad. Here it all is. And I flip-flopped so many times in what I thought about him. And I think probably the listeners will too. But I kind of put it all out there. And it's like, look, like this guy never got a trial. You're the jury that he never got.
Right.
And what do you think? And so I in the end, I say what I think. But to me, it's like I think listeners can sort of make a judgment for themselves and then take that judgment about what they think he did based on the evidence that we put out there. Kind of stack that up next to, OK, this is what he theoretically did to us, to the world, to the United States. Here's what he did to us. And here's what we, in particular the United States, did to him. And is there a balance here? Just to say, okay, now make that judgment for yourselves. And I certainly made that judgment, which I say in the final episode. But I think to me, a major part of it is that the listener can make those judgments for themselves too. Mm.
So let's pivot a little now. I was reading your bio, and in your bio you write that Harvard, where you received your PhD in history of science, was essentially, yep, and I quote, and by the way, for this one quote, I had to look up so many things. and here's the quote, 4 years, Harvard was essentially 4 years of spelunking in dusty archives and interviewing non-agenarians to research dissertation on the Tanganyika laughter epidemic of 1962. Okay, I have so many questions about this. Who are these non-agenarians, first of all?
The non-agenarians, so the 90-year-olds who I talked to, some of whom are still around, some of whom are sadly not. Basically, the thing I was interested in was, we're in the middle of a epidemic. Yeah. I was interested in a different epidemic that happened in the early 60s in East Africa. And the 90-year-old people I was talking to were the people who were there at that time. Hmm. Some of them were Swedish missionaries. Some of them were Tanzanian. It was then called Tanganyika. Tanzanian medical officials. Hmm. There was a guy who was an Indian doctor who was the district medical officer at the time. There were all these different people who were there at the time. And I was interviewing either them or people who knew them very well or their close relatives. I was interviewing all of these people who had insight into this thing that happened in 1962 in really a sort of a far-flung corner of East Africa that was not a well-trafficked area, but there were a bunch of people there who witnessed this outbreak, this epidemic that I was interested in firsthand. And so I talked to them and I did a lot of interviews with them, and they happened to be, all these people were sort of strewn all over the world. And so I traveled a bunch to go find them and talk to them and hear their take of what happened. Some of them were school teachers, some of them were missionaries, some of them were doctors, some of them were public health officials, some of them were, you know, just all kinds of different people.
So what was this epidemic and how did you choose this topic? Like, why did you decide to do research on this?
Yeah, so the epidemic was a very unusual thing, and it's still kind of an unusual thing. Basically, what it was an epidemic of pathological laughing and crying. So it was almost like an epidemic of what felt like a mental illness. And so the question was, what kind of an illness is this? Where often young people, sometimes mostly girls, but also men, women, elderly, boys, all kinds of different people, they would get this illness and then they would laugh and cry for, you know, hours at a time, at which point they would just be so exhausted they would pass out. This was very, very striking. And in a way, like for the people that were living through it, I mean, it sounds kind of funny, funny. Like, how could you laugh until you pass out? But it was actually quite nightmarish for them. Like, it felt more like a horror movie than a comedy. And it was this thing that would spread, and it would spread in very, very puzzling ways. And so a lot of local doctors, and then it would kind of escalate. So first it was the local doctors, then it was the district doctors, then it was the national doctors, and then it literally got to the World Health Organization, the top of the World Health Organization, where they were sending in doctors to be like, what is this thing that is happening in East Africa that is so puzzling? And so it was a medical mystery. It's an epidemic, and one that made kind of headlines all around the world. But then it sort of just petered out and was mysterious. And so to me, that was one of the things that appealed to me about it, was that it was a mystery. And huh. I wanted to find out more about it. And it sounded so odd and kind of, when I started, it sounded kind of funny. But when I started doing interviews, I realized, wait a second, this isn't as funny as I thought it was.
Yeah, because when I was reading your bio, I thought it was something more like, as you said, funny. I didn't realize what was the backstory.
Yeah, and I mean, there are things about humor in a way that it made me think about a lot. And actually, it's a lot of those thoughts that I'm having right now in the midst of this pandemic, like the way that laughter spreads, the way that illnesses spread. Mm. There was a quote that was attributed to Aristotle, although I don't think Aristotle said it. The quote is like, why is sickness contagious, but health is not? Which is like, why should the bad thing catch
That's
so
true.
Easily and the good thing doesn't?
That's so interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And in a way, I mean, laughter is, I think the question is wrong. I mean, I think it's a smart question, but I think the question is wrong, because the public health officials and epidemiologists and sociologists and all kinds of different people have shown us the ways in which actually good behavior spreads too, or good, you know, good things do spread. Health does weirdly spread. If a friend of a friend of yours quits smoking, it's more likely that you're going to quit smoking. Mm. Stuff like that. I mean, I'm quoting that study after like five, 10 years of not of remembering what it was. But there is a very strong idea that it's like, oh, wait a sec, we are actually, if nothing else, this pandemic is teaching us that we are all connected in ways that are barely perceptible, ways that it would be hard for us to even imagine, that we are all connected. And what does that mean? I think a lot of that was stuff that drew me to that particular kind of medical mystery, and not just in ways that, like, I mean, this is already, I mean, this COVID-2 is mysterious in its own way. Like, it's like, okay, how does it spread? Should we wear masks? Mm. Should we do this? Should we do that? There are all these questions that are still not fully answered, right?
Are you doing any story on COVID-19? Are you pursuing any project or lead on it?
Yeah. A bunch. Mm. We just did a story. I helped with a story that came out a few days ago about a history of medicine story, a history of public health story about this guy, Ignaz Semmelweis, who was basically the doctor who, it's a bit of a spoiler here, but he's basically the doctor who figured out that, you know, washing your hands could save lives. And so we tell, and it's really an epic story, because it was this moment where this doctor in the mid-19th century, this doctor in Vienna was basically going around, and it was almost like he was trying to solve a murder mystery. You know, there were all these women, often very poor women, who would be showing up to his hospital, and they would die and at very high rates in childbirth. And the delivering mothers would die. And so it was this mystery. He was like, why are this very high proportion of women one of the most advanced hospitals on planet Earth? Like, why are so many of them dying? Hmm. And what he found was that, and at the time, you know, the best way, and still today, one of the best ways to learn about the human body and learn, you know, how to keep people from dying is to study cadavers. And so he would be in the morning studying cadavers, and then in the afternoon he would be delivering babies. And then what he realized is, like, as he was reporting, you know, he's the detective trying to figure out this murder mystery. And what he realizes, oh, wait a second, you know, I'm not just the detective here. I'm the murderer here. Hmm. Like he kind of realized, wait a second, I've been carrying these. This was even before germ theory, so he didn't even know what bacteria were. He's like, I've been carrying what he called cadaver particles on his hands from the dead bodies.
Oh, wow.
And then bringing them to the obstetrics ward where you know, or the maternity ward where he's delivering these babies and infecting these mothers, and then they would be dying. So he kind of, it was this horrible, horrible realization where he was like, I was looking for the cause of these women's death. I was looking everywhere. Where, you know, no stone unturned, and then it turned out that the killer here was me, and me and all my colleagues were doing our best here, but we didn't realize like we were the harbingers of death. And so it's a kind of a haunting story. And what he realizes is, oh, the way to get rid of this is he basically would like bleach his hands.
Oh, wow.
Because he realized that's the way to get these cadaver particles off, and that's the way to save these women's lives. And I mean, it's like you tell this story. I mean, like the way that, and I've kind of butchered it in this tale, but the it's like an opera or something. It's so dramatic. It's sort of epic story of life and death and knowledge and ignorance and all these things. And what's cool is that like it sort of, you know, amid all the uncertainty and ignorance, and this is what I love about the history of science. Like you have this story where it's like, oh wow, somebody came up with this hard won little lesson that now is helping all of us, and that it's this mundane chore that now we're all doing 20 seconds at a time every day. But actually there's this epic story behind it, and you know, maybe that'll make people think about washing their hands in a different way and do it more. And help you know, curb this epidemic. So that was one story we're doing. I have a bunch more in the works, but yeah, we're sort of pivoted. Both the show I'm working for and myself have pivoted hard to COVID coverage.
So here's the thing: as a researcher and as a storyteller, I want to get your take on this. And talking about ignorance, this relates to that as well. We've seen there are states like New York and California who've passed directives and people are social distancing. And then there are some states in the South and even Midwest that do not want to do social distancing or a lockdown because they think that their freedom is much more important than anything else, which is so absurd on so many levels. What I have noticed in America over the last, say, decade is this disdain for science and logic in some parts of America.
Yeah.
Now, some may say it's because those parts are more like religiously affiliated or oriented, but I don't buy that. I don't buy the argument that if you are, if you believe in a certain religion or if you're a practicing Christian or Muslim or Jew, you will automatically develop some kind of disdain for science. What is your take on that? Why is that happening? How do we convince those people to understand the science of what's happening right now?
I guess I have a kind of bigger answer, but I think just to keep it specific to this moment right now and this question right now and these states right now, like I think that there is a move to, well, okay, let me put it this way. Like I think that states, like the idea of the states, right? It's like it's one country, but it feels like a bunch of countries. Mm. Like we're a mini United Nations here, right? Sort of being held together. And I think that there's a lot of times when that's a real value for us. Like that's the idea is like it's like 50 laboratories for democracy, you know, like 50 different ways to try new things. And maybe those things will, you know, in one place, something will work way better and then somewhere else can adapt it. Like that's the kind of idea of the 50 states, right? But this problem that we're facing needs to be a federal problem. Like it is a problem that transcends boundaries, and it's a problem that if one state does it wrong, it's going to spark onto other states, and it's going to, we can't solve it one by one.
Exactly.
This is a we need to solve it all together problem, and this is a problem that we need to solve all together. And it this virus does not care what your politics are. This virus does not care how you gender identify or what your, you know, what your religion is. It doesn't care about any of those things. And I think what we need to do is, like, I think this needs to be a stronger, more purposeful and science guided federal response. And sadly, there needed to have been a more urgent response, like 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And I am very pro the idea of states having their own like states' rights, freedoms to be able to be those laboratories for democracy, to try new things, to do different things. But like in this case, this is a threat that transcends all of those more like state level values. This is a bigger problem that we're a lot of people, especially the most vulnerable people, are going to be at risk. And that shouldn't be tolerable to anybody, you know?
But do you think these states are going to change? Do you think they will end up social distancing or going in a lockdown or something? Because it doesn't seem it's happening right now.
I know. It's so scary. And I think they should, like my personal opinion, I guess, is that I think they should be made to. But I think it's a really complicated situation in an environment where, as you say, like science has become partisan, in a way that it really oughtn't have been. And I think that there's just so many parts of this that are being bungled, and that we, in a nonpartisan way, you can say, like, I think that there are so many parts of this that have been bungled by all kinds of politicians. Like this is really a situation where I think now we need to get draconian. And it's a weird thing to say that, because like one of the headlines I read, especially coming out of this Guantanamo series that I just did, there was one headline that I was reading. It was in Politico a few weeks ago about how the Trump administration is pushing to get indefinite detention powers, like under the auspices of this current emergency and crisis, which is the same power that they got in the wake of 9/11 that ended up basically being Guantanamo,
exactly.
This indefinite detention power. And that feels, it feels so complicated,
yeah.
Because you think that, I really actually do think that the federal government should get an additional amount of power. I think this is a genuine emergency where things should, the federal government should have the power to do things that they otherwise wouldn't, but also like we've seen how badly that can go. So I don't know. I'm kind of ambivalent about it, but a bunch of other bipartisan way, lawmakers kind of very much rebuked and rejected that idea, that sort of power grab from the federal government, which I think is good.
But it can be misused.
It could very easily be misused. And like you can imagine, given this particular administration's track record, that they it's not encouraging.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like I do think that the federal government in this case should have extra powers for the kinds of reasons you just said, like to basically force states that are lagging behind even more and could have, you know, deadlier consequences to their actions, so that the federal government can force them to do what needs to be done.
Maybe you can do a series on America's relationship with science and how that has evolved and why it's different for different states. How is religion interwoven into that conversation? You know, maybe.
Yeah. It's such a rich and fascinating topic. When I was in grad school, there were a lot of people studying this very thing. You know, like the classic thing is like the Scopes trial and evolution, but it also creeps into so many different domains of American life. Like you have genetically modified foods and stem cells and abortion, and you know, there are all these different places where this seeming battle, and I agree with you, I think it's overhyped and there's a classic book that, I'm forgetting now what the name of it, but this war between science and religion, that idea where it got framed, and I think it's a false dichotomy, but I think that it's like that this country sort of bought into it hard. And that it has affected so many domains of our lives and public space. Like it really is this particular sort of false narrative has wreaked a lot of havoc for a long time.
Yeah. So this next question is a bit more philosophical.
Sure.
And let's see where we go with it. In your opinion, why are stories so important? Why should we care about stories?
I think there's so many ways to answer this, and I have so many thoughts about it, but I think generally, like if I was to try to zoom it out to one at this moment, what I would say was, I think we all have this, there's this kind of inertia we have being in our own brains that you sort of default to your own perspective, and you need kind of a real, real powerful crowbar to kind of pry you loose of your own brain and to let you see the world from other perspectives and see that your brain isn't the only brain, that there's a lot of other people with a lot of other perspectives that really need to be considered in a lot of your own actions and a lot of the ways that we make decisions that govern us all. And I think storytelling is that crowbar, you know? It's that thing that helps you when you listen to it. It helps you sort of sneakily consider other perspectives, and it's a tool like any others. Like, I mean, people can use it to just entrench themselves in their own brain and to do things like that. But I really think that, like, the way that I try to do this art form is like it really is to vault people out of their own minds, out of their own, like, we all have our own very, very limited tunnel vision, no matter how hard we try to kind of crack it open. And stories are the way that you can imagine yourself into being other people, into feeling what other people feel, into seeing the problems that other people face, even if you have not faced them yourself. It helps you to care. It helps you to empathize. It helps you to do all of those kinds of things that I think is a crucial ingredient for a society to work, for a society as diverse, as geographically sprawling, demographically, you know, like I think that the place we are as a modern civilization, it really requires without that ability, that ability to consider, you know, people who are not you, I think our whole society would fall apart.
So how do you decide, like, since there are like so many people and bold happenings out in the world, how do you decide which narratives to tell? Is it difficult?
Yeah, it's really difficult. I think for me, like, kind of the criteria I have in my head always is, like, there's like two criteria, really. It's like, is this story important and is this story interesting? Is this story, does it have high stakes? Does it make a difference? Is it meaningful? Is it going to change someone's life? Does it affect a lot of people a little bit, or a few people a lot, or does it affect a lot of people a lot? That's kind of the stakes, the important question. And then the kind of interesting question is this fun and weird, and is it different from everything else that I've heard before, or everything else that I expected would be true? Like, if I sort of was painting by numbers that experience of another person with my own imagination, like, could I have even imagined this story, you know? And I think, to me, it's like the stories that I'm drawn to are the ones that are ideally both interesting and important, ones that feel like they make a difference. They are really, they, like, you know, they could, yeah, they're consequential, but also ones that are surprising and delightful and have emotions and characters and plot twists and that kind of thing that can kind of keep my attention and feel like I'm watching a great movie. And then sort of smuggled in there are these questions or ideas that really, that can make a dent, you know, that can make a very subtle, but like a dent in the minds of the people that hear that story, and that will make them kind of experience the world, you know, this either can kind of convince them that there's a whole new world that exists out there that they couldn't have imagined, or that the world that they do see every day and take for granted, that they can see it in a new way, and that it's fresh and that it's new, and that it feels like, oh, I need to reconsider this thing that I thought, you know, I could take for granted.
In the end, if you were to define America, how would you do that?
So part of this series also is I just became a citizen. And so I've been thinking about this a lot, because I in a way, I signed up for this. Like, it's like, what did I even sign up for? And I think the thing that I signed up for, which I would define as America, is it's a bunch of values. It's like it's a place where people fought for and decided what to fight for, and what they decided was not, you know, it's not about you know, some kind of like, this is our ancestral line or something. It's fought for based on values. And those values are really important. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, you know, habeas corpus, the rule of law, the, you know, the right to a fair trial, the I think a welcoming of immigrants, a, you know, like all these kinds of things that, that you're like, oh, okay, I get that thing. And I get why that's important. And I get why we all should ought to live in a society where those things are true. The freedom of speech, the freedom of religion. Like, these are all values that, that to me, like, when I sort of interrogate them, I think, yeah, that's right. That's good. That's a thing that we should have, that everybody should have. You know, and I think there are certainly moments where that gets perverted, where that gets taken to an extreme, where that gets taken, you know, to a place where that feels uncomfortable for me. And that feels like an, or that we've kind of fully stumbled in exactly the wrong direction. And I think Guantanamo is one of those, a very prime example of that. But I think in general, to me, America is this bag of values. And it's kind of like, it's, it sort of just puts its, you know, unlike like country, like I think England has no constitution, right? Like, so it's like, look, like we're writing down, we're putting our money where our mouth is. This is, these are the things we stand for, and this is it. And I think, like, I look at that list and I'm like, yeah, I agree with basically all of this. Like, I think this, this is right. We should, these are great rules to create a society by, and that, and that, and that's what America is. It's those values and rules. And I think that that's, like within that there's a lot. And it gets complicated, but in general, to say, here we are, these are the things that we care about. And to me, I'm like, yeah, a lot of those seem like they're worth caring about and worth fighting for and worth standing up for.
Thank you so much, Latif. This was wonderful. Where can people find the podcast?
It's now, you can find it on its own feed, wherever you get your podcast. It's called The Other Latif, The Other Latif, maybe you would say. so it's on Apple Podcasts, it's on Stitcher, it's on a whole bunch of other places. Wherever you get your podcast, you can find it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time and your wonderful questions.
Thank you so much, guys, for listening to our show. If you liked it, please share it. That's how we grow our podcast. And if you don't know this, we are on Twitter and Instagram. Our Twitter handle is at immigrantly_pod. And on Instagram, we are at immigrantlypod. Be sure to tune in next week when we will bring you another incredible story. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay home, and social distance as much as you can. Take care.